We look back on the year that was and the year that might have been. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, March 10th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, today marks the one-year anniversary of the first presumed positive case of SARS-CoV-2 in the state. We take you back through the year that we endured together, remember those we lost, and look to the future of vaccines and hugs and gathering together once again. First up, South Dakota's Secretary of State Kim Mulsam-Risden and state epidemiologist Josh Clayton will talk about the state's pandemic response from preparation to vaccination. Then a timeline from day one to the day the first vaccines arrived in the state, Jackie Hendry reports. Plus, faith leaders talk about weathering the pandemic. That's coming later in the hour. News is first. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. State lawmakers are prepping to redraw legislative district boundaries. The Redistricting Commission will meet monthly until census data comes from the federal government. Officials anticipate that data will arrive on September 30th. Once the data arrives, they will start working on drawing the state's 35 legislative district lines. Representative Mike Derby sat on the Redistricting Commission in 2001. He foresees two challenges heading into this year's Redistricting Commission.
The late data from the census, and then also the rapid growth we've had in the major urban areas, and that's going to be our biggest challenges, I see.
Some lawmakers anticipate the greater Sioux Falls area down into Lincoln County will get another legislative seat. The commission will hold field hearings in mid-October across the state, including Rapid City, Mission, Mobridge, Aberdeen, Watertown, and Sioux Falls. Advocates for a voter-passed measure to legalize marijuana in South Dakota are condemning a taxpayer-funded lawsuit from Governor Kristi Noem opposing it. A firm currently bills the governor's office for legal services at a rate of $190 an hour for partners and $170 an hour for associates, according to a contract with the firm. The legal battle for the measure is set to enter its final round at the state Supreme Court. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has awarded more than $11.5 million to South Dakota. $2 million goes to Sioux Falls and Rapid City, but most of the money will go to smaller communities. SDPB's David Ozzetti Scott has more.
The federal grants pay for economic development projects, affordable housing, and urban renewal. Michelle Schulke manages Rapid City's Community Development Block Grant Program. Schulke says agencies and organizations can apply for funds each fall. They'll use this year's in a variety of ways.
We'll be funding a public service program that assists clients in obtaining free pharmaceutical medications. We're also funding a rent and mortgage assistance program. We will be working at a public facility to renovate two entrances for accessibility modifications. And then lastly, we'll be using some funds for actually a kitchen exhaust fan for youth and family services.
Schulke says the city will also set funds aside for housing projects that come up over the next year. Shelley Unruh is the housing manager for Sioux Falls. She says affordable housing is an issue for most growing communities.
Much like the rest of the nation, it's affordable housing is an issue, and as we continue to grow and add jobs, the need for affordable housing only increases for our area. So the strategy that we're taking is really looking at using the funding that we do have available to leverage that to create the deepest density that we can in housing.
Unruh says federal funds subsidize building projects to keep new homes affordable. She points to ongoing developments in the city where old buildings are coming down to make way for new housing. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm David Ozzetti Scott in Rapid City.
For weather today, we're seeing a winter storm warning in effect for the southwest as well as the northeast, and a winter weather advisory in effect for those areas as well, in addition to central South Dakota until later tonight. We're looking at snow in the northeast, snow in the west, and rain in the southeast later this afternoon. Today's highs are in the lower 30s to the lower 40s statewide. Later tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of snow across the state, evening lows in the upper teens to the lower 20s. Up next, it's In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Empty storefronts aren't a rare sight in New York City. A lot of businesses took a pause in this pandemic, but oh, what a difference a year makes.
Just a year ago, I was looking up bankruptcy laws, and a year later, I'm looking for a second space.
I'm Kai Rizdal, a comeback for commercial spaces. We'll have that story for you. The numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team working together to serve your needs. Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
SDPB provides comprehensive coverage of the South Dakota State Legislature all session long. Listen on SDPB Radio and to our daily podcasts. SDPB-TV presents late-night replays of the day's general session and access to the legislature live online at SD.net and on the SDNet app. SDPB's coverage grants all citizens access to democracy in action. More at sdpb.org/statehouse.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. On February 26th of 2020, Dr. Josh Clayton, South Dakota State epidemiologist, joined us on In the Moment to discuss a worsening flu season and concerns about a novel coronavirus. The state had already begun preparing for the possibility of SARS-CoV-2 in South Dakota, although many unexpected challenges lie ahead. On March 10th, Governor Kristi Noem announced the first presumed positive COVID-19 case in the state, found in a resident who had recently traveled home from outside the state. Today, we look back at 1 year of COVID in South Dakota, and we look forward to what happens next as we continue to fight back a global pandemic. We begin the hour with South Dakota's Secretary of Health, Kim Mulsom-Risden, and Dr. Josh Clayton, South Dakota State Epidemiologist. Secretary Mulsom-Risden, welcome back to In the Moment. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Clayton, welcome back as well.
Thank you, Lori.
Dr. Clayton, I want to start with you because I was going back to find out the first time that we had talked about the possibility of SARS-CoV-2 and what we were seeing ahead. And you had already been preparing for weeks by the time we talked with you about it on the show. There were about 52 or so flu hospitalizations at the time, and you had concerns about that flu season. We're working with the federal government about, you know, the federal stockpile and things like that. Tell us a little bit. We'll start with you, Dr. Clayton, and then ask Secretary Mulsom-Risden the same question. Some of those early conversations that you were having about this virus when we heard about it in Wuhan, when we saw it come to, you know, the West Coast and the East Coast, what were some of those early conversations like?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Lori. So I think it's important to you know, understand kind of when the what's now known as SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes coronavirus or COVID-19, you know, was first really identified in Wuhan. We started to really hear a little bit about that over the end of December, so around the time of Christmas of 2019. And you know, it was really identified. The virus was sequenced by Chinese government and some of their academic professionals. The very first part of January, which really did help provide some perspective of what we were dealing with. You know, but it's still at that point, what we knew is that it was a new virus. That it was causing a lot of pneumonia, and a lot of people were being hospitalized with it. And so the focus initially was just learning, you know, about what was being relayed from those first infections to the CDC, as well as what they were providing to state health departments, and really discussing that. internally within the South Dakota Department of Health, and starting those first discussions of what our preparedness for this virus could look like. And you know, some of those discussions were, you know, how transmissible is this virus going to be? You know, are the what we're hearing about hospitalizations and the severe pneumonia that it causes, you know, was that potentially inflated, or you know, were those numbers a true representation of the overall severity of infection, and really to what extent had it been circulating, you know, in China, and really then taking those that information and applying what we knew and what we had available, which is our pandemic flu plan. You know, we have all sorts of information about, you know, how to work around individuals who are traveling, you know, with a novel novel influenza virus. You know, what we need to be doing to work with our hospitals and health systems to make sure that they're prepared to take care of individuals who may be unusually sick. Because essentially the discussion around the pandemic is, it's a typically a new virus, an emerging virus, and it's something where, because of that, you don't have any immunity within the population. And so it means that you will see a lot more people becoming sick and a lot more people being hospitalized after that initial introduction.
Yeah. Secretary Malsom-Risden, the same question. You know, those early conversations, and when you look back at them now, what do you feel particularly confident about that, you know, you were prepared for what was coming, and where are the areas where, boy, you wish you had known this just a couple weeks sooner?
Yeah, you know, in those early days, it was really important that we get our team put together so that we were really able to track the different pieces of information that were kind of filtering out. So it was important that we had people from our preparedness division that really are in the planning of responses like this. Certainly our EPI team, our contact tracing team, we knew that there was going to be some element of needing to kind of follow up with folks. We didn't know exactly what that would look like, of course, in the beginning, but we knew that was going to probably come into the picture. Certainly our laboratory staff, you know, you'll remember that in the beginning, you know, the testing options were extremely limited. And so, you know, we didn't know, you know, not only, you know, how COVID was being spread, but we really didn't know how to test effectively for it. And so a lot of questions in those early days, and, you know, it was really important that we, you know, assemble a large team just to kind of get through all the different things that we are learning every single day to help us, you know, in the coming days. You know, back to what I wish I would have known, I mean, I think there's just been, you know, a lot of evolving knowledge around coronavirus. And so had we known more early on about how it spreads, I think that would have been super helpful in terms of, you know, mitigating that spread. You know, our understanding of that has you know, evolved and continues to evolve, quite frankly. And so, you know, it's been, it's just been something that we've had to really keep up on, because there have been, you know, a lot of new discoveries around it. Now we're obviously talking about vaccines and therapeutics, which is certainly very promising, but certainly lots of changes in the last year.
Secretary Malsom-Risden, one of the things Dr. Clayton and I talked about back in February of last year, when we were talking about the flu, which I found interesting when I listened back to the conversation, was just how hard it is for South Dakotans to stay home when they're sick. Maybe that's the same across the country, I don't know, but we were commenting on, you know, we get up, we go to work, we send our kids to school, we, you know, head out to the fields or into the kitchen or whatever our task is for the day, and we keep going. I'm curious, after a year of contact tracing and hearing from, you know, business leaders and people who have called your department and your contact tracers, was that something that culturally we had to overcome, this idea that people really needed to understand how important it was to do the simple act of staying home when you were sick?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, you know, was identified as one of the early mitigation strategies that, you know, we employed. And I, you know, I would just tell you this, Lori, I think the experience in South Dakota has been great. I know some other states really ran into issues with, you know, folks kind of giving their state departments of health a hard time. I think by and large, you know, we talked to some frustrated people, that is for sure. But I think people really, stepped up and wanted to do the right thing. And so I think when we explained, you know, that the guidance really to keep that person safe and to really keep others safe was to stay home. You know, most people were really, accepting of that. Didn't mean that they liked it and that it wasn't inconvenient. But, you know, by and large, I think South Dakotans really did what they needed to do with that.
Yeah. And Dr. Clayton, of course, the challenge with this, which makes it different than the flu and other things, was just how much asymptomatic spread there was. So people were not even aware that they were carrying the virus and they were spreading it to people. Tell us a little bit about what we now know about SARS-CoV-2 and perhaps some of the variants that we didn't know at the beginning about its transmission and how deadly it can be.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, we very quickly on learned, you know, that individuals were able to transmit the virus, spread it person to person. Those small droplets that are expelled when you're coughing, talking, sneezing, singing, and so on. And, you know, what we really didn't fully understand at that point was both the potential, in poorly ventilated areas, for some of those droplets to stay in the air a little bit longer and to, in some ways, appear or mimic airborne transmission, and then on top of that, having, very mild symptoms in a number of individuals, and seeing estimates even to this day, between 16 and 40% of individuals are able to be infected and continue that spread of COVID-19 with very mild symptoms that they might not stay home with or be totally asymptomatic. And that does help drive transmission of SARS-CoV-2.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Melson Risen, you talked about, and when Governor Kristi Noem was on this show and I asked her, you know, what she wished could have gone better, she mentioned the same thing you did, which was the extreme limitation of testing in the very early days was a challenge to be overcome. The South Dakota legislative session in their special session, there were some proposals to give the Department of Health more funding for contact tracing and for testing. That did not pass during the special session last October. Did you feel at that point that you had enough funding and enough sort of staffing to do the testing and contact tracing? Do you feel that you have that now?
Yeah, I will say that funding really has not been a barrier to our response. We've gotten, a lot of federal support in that arena. In fact, we've received more in federal grants for our COVID response than what our total annual department budget is in a year. So funding has not really been the barrier. Finding staff is a barrier, and we have to work very hard at that. It really, though, did help us become innovative and use technology to a much larger degree, and we think that's going to be a big resource improvement for us, well after COVID. And so, I kind of look at it as if we can go through a crisis, go through a pandemic, go through an unprecedented year like we have and come out stronger as an agency, as I think we will, then I think we've done good work. Relative to testing, we actually just today hit the 1 million mark in terms of tests. And so where we started as a country and as a state to where we're at now are just, very, very different. And so, that's been a really good development and working, with our labs across the state to kind of build that capacity so that, when we see the need for new testing down the road, there are some things in place that we didn't have necessarily, at the start of the pandemic. I think that'll be a good outcome of the COVID response as well.
We have had 1,904 at last count South Dakotans die from COVID-19, and our per capita rate is currently somewhere around 8th in the nation. And I just say that to bring up the point that almost every one of us knows somebody that they lost from COVID-19 or that was incredibly ill with COVID-19 or that had mild symptoms. It's part of, regardless of what the numbers show, it is part of our lives this past year in a way that I think we will never forget. And I'm wondering, you know, you and your staffs, you both are, you know, trying to keep yourself safe, trying to keep your staff working, dealing with your own families and your own worries and anxieties as human beings. And Dr. Clayton, I just want to ask you, like, what was the low point for you during this pandemic? What was the, you know, think of a moment where you couldn't sleep or where you were just fretting over something that was happening you couldn't do anything about. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
I really think for me, the low point in terms of you know, how I felt about, you know, kind of my impact, you know, on the broader things was just seeing that in continuous march, an increase in cases that we saw, which culminated in November 12th, having the highest number of cases, you know, reported, reaching our peak in the pandemic. And, you know, we had been doing a lot of, you know, investigation. We had been doing a lot of communication for how individuals can protect themselves against becoming infected with COVID-19, kind of that focus on stopping the spread. And, you know, despite all of those, you know, really strong efforts by us and our partners, you know, we're still seeing those cases increase. I think probably one of the highlights, you know, was knowing those first doses of vaccine, you know, coming into the state. So, you know, just a month later, you know, and having the first FDA EUA approved vaccines coming into the state, working with our partners to make sure that we were vaccinating people as soon as we got that vaccine in state, has really been the wave that has carried me, you know, since that mid-December point.
Yeah. Secretary Molson-Risden, that was 2,000 on November 12th, cases and new cases in a single day. And then, as Dr. Clayton said, a month later, the first delivery of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine arrives in the state. What was your low point? What were one of the days where it just, you know, you're a human being, it got to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, definitely around that same time where it was just, you know, really wanting to see the numbers look to be trending in a different direction and feeling like we were really doing what we could to help effectuate that. You know, I would also kind of layer in that it was at that time that our hospitals were really feeling a lot of stress. And so we were seeing, you know, large numbers of hospital staff who themselves were sick. So we were seeing, you know, stress on our hospital partners in that regard, and then just the increasing numbers of people to take care of. And again, you know, that was something that has been very pivotal to our response, was making sure that our hospitals were well equipped and that they, you know, could take care of sick people. And they were really feeling the stress at that time. And, you know, I think, you know, everybody was just looking for something that somebody could do to make a change. And, you know, there just weren't, you know, magic bullets. And it was just a really tense time at that point. But I would totally echo that vaccines have given us hope and optimism, and people are stepping up. We have seen, in fact, we've seen over 70% of people aged 65 and older in our state be vaccinated, and those are great numbers. And again, those are very vulnerable people. And so matching, you know, great vaccination rates to the folks that are really going to benefit the most from them is a good place to be, and that's where we're at. And that's because of a lot of hard work from a lot of people across the state.
Yeah. The messaging around masks as the research evolved, and I'm not asking about a mask mandate, but I am asking about the messaging, was politicized nationally. It was incredibly passionate conversations in municipalities and city council meetings across the state. Is there anything, Secretary Molson-Risden, you feel you could have done differently with the messaging around wearing masks that might have made a difference?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Lori. I remember very distinctly being asked about masks, and at the time, early on, you know, the CDC recommendation was to not wear a mask. And, you know, and again, people were just looking for ways to help, I think, and to do something that would make a difference. And at the time, the recommendation was not to mask. I think then as that recommendation changed, it was really hard for people to see that, for what it was worth from just a scientific perspective. I think it had already been politicized by that point, and it was really hard to kind of turn the conversation to, what we now knew about masking. And so, I think it's, I really do feel bad that it did get politicized. I just think it's a pretty basic way that people can take care of themselves and others. And, we know now that it is effective. And so, I wish, again, I hadn't been the one to say, don't wear a mask, because it was really hard to, get people to kind of go down that road when we knew differently.
Yeah. Dr. Clayton, early on, a lot of the doctors who were coming on the show were talking about wearing masks. It was not wearing the N95 masks to take them away from the healthcare providers. I think in the first few weeks of COVID-19, people were sewing masks and bringing them to hospitals for fear of shortages. And I want to ask you about masks now, Dr. Clayton, and going forward, especially as the vaccines roll out and people get vaccinated, there is still a lot of work to be done. What do you want to leave people with that we should still be doing regarding mitigation?
So I think it's important to recognize that vaccine is one tool in the toolbox of prevention measures that we have been really focused on for the duration of COVID-19. Going back to initial discussion about masks, the evolution of what we've really known in terms of the protection of masks, we know that the N95 masks are very good because they're respirator masks at preventing, if worn appropriately, at preventing virus and coming into a person's mouth and breathing that in. We also knew that the surgical masks that are used for those procedure masks, were at a standard that they were meeting, and early on it was focused that both of those sets of masks were to be preserved for healthcare, and the availability, of individual sewing masks and masks becoming, readily available product out there, the cloth masks, has been a great addition to the tools that we've had in the toolbox. But, even for individuals who are fully vaccinated, we have to have a focus of still maintaining a lot of those same precautions. Making sure that you're physically distancing greater than 6 feet, avoiding crowds, and when you can't do that, that you're wearing a mask. And then in addition, all of the things that we talk about, covering your cough and sneezes, washing your hands often, and the new guidance that has come out from CDC for individuals who are vaccinated or are fully vaccinated, which is 2 weeks after your second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 weeks after your dose of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, is that you can get together in small groups with other people who are fully vaccinated, that you can have a family member who's fully vaccinated visiting, a family who are not fully vaccinated. So that might mean a reunion of, a grandparent or grandparents with, their kids and grandkids. So this is really a very nice step forward. So that, we can really start getting back to normal. And the thing I would leave with is that, life will slowly get back to normal. And, let's not get ahead of ourselves because we are still in the pandemic response. We have a lot more people to vaccinate.
Yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves. But I have seen a couple of those first hugs, and it is sweet and worth waiting for. Secretary Kim Mulsum-Risden, thank you not only for joining us today, but for a year of dedicated service and work from you and your staff. Dr. Josh Clayton, same gratitude for you. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
We will take a break when we come back. Jackie Hendry brings you a timeline of COVID-19 in South Dakota from the arrival of the first case to the arrival of the first vaccines. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, MIT professor Sherry Turkle, who spent decades studying the impact of digital technology on our culture. She has a new memoir about growing up in Brooklyn and becoming a leading academic, and about family secrets she only understood when she began asking questions in her 20s. Her book is called The Empathy Diaries. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by The Perfect Hanging Gallery since 1973. Your Main Street answer for custom framing, antique maps, selected gifts, and regional art. 621 Main, Rapid City. More at perfecthanginggallery.com.
While the Grammy Awards ceremony is this weekend, nominations for Canada's version of the Grammys, the Juno Awards, have been announced. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear music from some of the Canadian jazz artists up for Junos this year, including bassist Brandy Disterheft, guitarist Jocelyn Gould, vocalist Diana Krall, saxophonist Pat LaBarbera and Kirk McDonald, and others. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As we look back on 1 year of COVID-19 in South Dakota, almost all of us have lost something. A loved one, a job, a sense of security. Perhaps we have also gained a sense of community, of resilience, of perspective. In a year of turbulence, anxiety, and grief, it's also easy to forget exactly what unfolded during this pandemic and when, especially as people seek to define their own narratives of pandemic response. SDPB's Jackie Hendry brings you this timeline of our year of COVID. Here is what we've been through.
It was Tuesday, March 10th, 2020, when Governor Kristi Noem made this announcement.
Good afternoon. The state's public health laboratory has confirmed the first presumptive positive cases of COVID-19 in the state of South Dakota.
She announced five cases tied to out-of-state travel and the state's first COVID-related death. It was an introduction to three words that would dominate the year: COVID-19, coronavirus, and pandemic. 3 days later, by March 13th, there were 1,600 cases throughout the United States.
To unleash the full power of the federal government through this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency. Two very big words.
That same day, Governor Noem declared a state of emergency in South Dakota. She called on all public K-12 schools to close for the week and encouraged private schools to do the same.
I'm recommending that the schools use this time to clean their facilities and to prepare for the following week.
Students would be out of the classroom for the rest of the year. On March 23rd, State Representative Bob Glanzer of Huron told the Argus Leader he had tested positive for COVID-19. Governor Noem issued an executive order that would set the tone of her response to the pandemic. Noem had guidance for individuals, employers, and healthcare organizations. It also led to some confusion.
I was just looking through your executive order. It says municipal governments should. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a legal requirement or is that advice?
Is telling them what they should do.
The governor asked South Dakota residents to exercise personal responsibility. Through April, that phrase signaled the governor's pandemic approach. Noem stuck with conservative principles of limited government intervention, even as a majority of states were issuing shutdown orders and imposing stay-at-home restrictions.
The calls to apply for a one-size-fits-all approach to this problem in South Dakota is herd mentality. It's not leadership.
That left every city and county to create its own approach to the pandemic. Huron, an early hotspot in the state, was among the first to issue emergency ordinances closing bars, restaurants, and other public gathering areas. On April 3rd, less than 2 weeks after his diagnosis was made public, Huron Representative Bob Glanzer died from COVID-19. Days later, South Dakota had 288 positive COVID-19 cases, most of them in Minnehaha and Lincoln counties. Governor Noem issued an executive order to high-risk residents of those counties.
This group of individuals needs to take this very seriously. I need this group in Minnehaha and Lincoln counties to stay home. For the next 3 weeks, that is your directive through this executive order, is to stay home.
By mid-April, Sioux Falls became a hotspot with more than 200 COVID cases tied to the Smithfield meatpacking plant. Governor Noem and Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken asked the company to close the plant for 2 weeks. It shut down indefinitely on April 12th, spurring concerns about pork shortages around the nation. Nearly 1,300 employees eventually tested positive, and 4 died. In late April, Governor Noem released a new strategy for the state. She called it the Back to Normal Plan. It encouraged employers to begin transitioning remote workers back to the office. It asked schools to consider an in-person check-in with students before the end of the year, and called on healthcare providers to build up a supply of independently sourced personal protective equipment. Criteria for this plan assumed the number of cases would start to go down. That didn't happen. In response to rising cases, the Cheyenne River and Oglala Sioux tribes set up highway checkpoints on reservation boundaries. Cheyenne River's tribal chairman, Harold Frazier, said it was a way to aid contact tracing and prevent further spread of the disease in his community.
I feel we have to try something to assist us and kind of keep it minimal as possible. So we feel that this is a good mechanism to do that.
Native Americans account for 9% of the state's population, but they account for 19% of COVID hospitalizations and 14% of the state's COVID deaths. Meanwhile, the governor was looking ahead to summer. There were plans in the works for a 4th of July fireworks celebration at Mount Rushmore. It would be the first in more than a decade, following a National Park Service report that such an event would not significantly harm the environment. COVID projections at the time showed South Dakota hitting peak infections in mid-June.
Are you concerned that it could potentially spread infections around with that number of people gathering in one place?
No, we're going to continue to evaluate the event and what it looks like, if people will be there, how many people will be there, and how we'll facilitate it.
In May, then-President Donald Trump told a conservative talk show host he planned to attend the Mount Rushmore event. In early June, Governor Noem announced a lottery system would make 7,500 tickets available for people to attend the Mount Rushmore fireworks show. As COVID-19 cases continued to rise nationwide, Governor Noem told guests they should not expect social distancing measures.
What I'm going to ask people to continue to do is, if you're sick, stay home. If you're the vulnerable population and you're worried about the virus, then you should stay home. People will have all the information that they need to know exactly what it will look like at Mount Rushmore, so they can make a decision for themselves if they'd like to attend or not.
On July 3rd, the governor addressed a full house.
When we had the ticket system set up, we had over 125,000 people sign up in a 3-day period to get to be one of the 7,500 people that are sitting here tonight in these seats for this celebration. Congratulations to all of you that are here in place.
And President Trump made good on his word.
And a very special hello to South Dakota.
4 days later, the nation surpassed 3 million COVID-19 cases. Throughout July and August, school leaders weighed their options for the fall. They looked for a safe way to get students back in the classroom. Governor Noem told reporters she would not issue another statewide school closure.
The science is very clear on schools. Our schools should be open.
When students did return, the state's public universities required masks in public indoor spaces on campus. but each K through 12 district decided its own policy. Some districts, like Rapid City, chose to wait and see how one of the state's biggest summer events would impact local cases.
COVID? You must caught the fear.
The Sturgis Motorcycle Rally brought more than 300,000 people from around the country to the state in mid-August. Sturgis organizers cut back on many of the group activities and events, saying they knew many people would come whether there was an official rally or not. Despite some efforts to prevent virus transmission, by the end of the month, the state's COVID cases were up. The spike continued through September as the Midwest gained national attention for its rising case counts. The Brookings City Council became the first to pass a temporary mask mandate after 3 hours of public comment. Near the end of September, the state set a record number of 579 new COVID cases reported in a single day. In early October, state lawmakers met for a special session on how to spend federal CARES Act funds. The pandemic relief money went to state programs, businesses, and individuals through grants and unemployment payments. However, during the special session, lawmakers rejected proposals to ramp up COVID testing and contact tracing. Later in October, the state began to set new records for COVID infection. On October 20th, the Department of Health reported 1,559 new cases of COVID-19. A week later, another record, 395 COVID patients hospitalized in the state. Various hospital and health leaders launched the Mask Up SODAC campaign to encourage mitigation efforts, but case counts continued to climb. By early November, 480 South Dakotans were hospitalized from COVID-19. Dr. Mike Elliott with Avera McKennan Hospital in Sioux Falls explained the situation to reporters.
We just don't have enough critical care trained nurses. We don't have enough intensivists. We don't have enough people to take care of all of these patients that are coming in.
At that point, South Dakota was one of three states in the region without a statewide mask mandate. As Election Day drew near, Governor Noem traveled the country campaigning for President Trump. She continued to say state restrictions and mask mandates were not the right way to respond. Both Avera and Sanford Health Systems expressed support for a statewide policy, and more municipalities began to enact local ordinances. On November 12th, a new record, more than 2,000 new COVID cases in a single day. On Thanksgiving, there were more than 800 empty chairs set up on the state capitol lawn and pier to signify South Dakotans who died from the coronavirus. December would be the state's deadliest month, another 542 people dead. But also in December.
Breaking news, the Food and Drug Administration has just approved the first COVID-19 vaccine for use in the U.S.
By mid-December, South Dakota got its first shipments of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. They were followed by doses of the Moderna vaccine. By the end of January, South Dakota was among the top states in the nation for vaccine distribution. Infection and death rates began to trend downward from the fall surge. In late February, newly elected President Biden led a moment of silence for the 500,000 Americans who died from COVID-19 in the past year. 1,901 of those were South Dakotans. More than 100,000 of the state's residents have recovered from COVID-19, and now, a year since the first COVID-19 cases were reported in the state, nearly a third of South Dakota's population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine.
SDPB's Jackie Hendry. You can find that story and more on our website at sdpb.org/news. We'll talk about the role of faith during the pandemic. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm
I'm Tanya Mosley. Journalist Jonkelin Hill could not get out of her head the story of an 8-year-old who went missing in D.C. Relisha Rudd disappeared from a homeless shelter 7 years ago.
She's this little black girl, and I was once a little black girl, and I know we're often aren't afforded the vulnerability that other girls are given.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at SDNCommunications.com.
1 year ago, most schools shut down around the country, and learning went remote. For teachers, it was heartbreaking.
You really miss me, don't you?
I do. You're not a teacher if you can't be with your kids.
Now, as many schools reopen, we check in with educators and their students to see how they've adapted. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB. SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in businesses around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In South Dakota, churches were not required to shut down, leaving church leaders with a variety of decisions to make regarding virus mitigation and the safety of the faithful. As we look back on 1 year of COVID in South Dakota, we welcome Costanza Hagemeyer. She's bishop for the South Dakota Synod with the ELCA, and Donald DeGroote. He is bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Sioux Falls. Bishop Hagemeyer, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here again. Thanks, Lori.
And Bishop DeGroote, welcome as well.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back a year because it just so happened that in January of 2020, we were doing a project on this show called The Future of Faith. And we were talking about how, you know, faith families and congregations were evolving, some of the challenges that churches were facing throughout the state. And we had talked to both of you, and the future all of a sudden changed pretty quickly. Bishop Hagemeyer, tell me when you first kind of came to the realization that this pandemic was going to be, you know, something that we hadn't seen before.
So my husband at that time, My husband is still my husband, but at that time last year, he was in Europe. So about 3 weeks before it arrived here, he would give me reports out of Europe. And it was very clear, very quickly to me that this is not short-lived. So every time I had conversations, I called what is going to come our way and what then came our way, an ice age. This is not a blizzard. Mm. This is an ice age I set from the beginning of the pandemic. It was in my vocabulary that this will affect how we are people, not just of God, but people.
Yeah. And I think that's really significant because, you know, so much, we were saying in those early days, well, South Dakotans know how to prepare for a blizzard. You know, we're going to stay home for 2 weeks. Vice President Pence at the time had the 100-day plan. There was some talk at the federal level of, you know, we'll gather for Easter. That's what President Trump wanted. But yet at the same time, there was this underlying, you know, knowledge or awareness that it was a lot more than that. And you saw that right away in the sense that as an ice mm-hmm. age, it's going to change literally everything of how we, mm-hmm. fascinating. Bishop DeGroote, you were transitioning yourself at the time. Tell us a little bit about some of your early memories of the beginning days of the pandemic.
Yeah, so thank you. I was ordained on February 13th.
And so already by, like early March, we were certainly getting signs that, hold on, something was going on here. I think the biggest challenge for me has been through this time is, what's the objective, what are the objective facts? And that's hard to come to when you have something that's unknown. So certainly the indications on many media reports were that it was going to be something very significant, and certainly has been significant for a number of people, even within our own state, as far as serious impact. But there's also a broad range of impacts, based on people's health conditions, age, all those various factors. So back in March 19th, the way we approached it, I really just sensed in prayer and consultation and based on the data we had at the time to give a dispensation for all Catholics in the diocese that they were not required to attend Mass and close the churches down for a short period of time. But already by May 15th, seeing that there's already kind of tracking things and seeing, well, hold on, now it's only affecting significantly certain people and certain classes and conditions, and how do we find this balance, right? And so for me, it's been a lot of prayerful discernment, tracking the trends, the information that we have, where we can get some accurate data on, for example, things like hospitalization, use of respirators, deaths, those kinds of things, certainly gives us a clearer sense of the significant impact. Certainly has changed so many things. A lot of things have moved to virtual, of course. But opening the church back up on May 15th, churches back up on May 15th, enabled people who wanted to come to Mass to still have that opportunity, who were not in those same categories of risk. And yet providing for those who didn't feel comfortable to, and it would have been prudent that they didn't have to come to Mass, right, sort of free about. And then on August 10th, I adjust the dispensation because, again, watching things change and as the effects were diminishing, if you will, by mid-August, just keeping the dispensation in place for those who were not healthy enough or those who cared for those who weren't healthy, like, for example, hospital workers, those with underlying conditions. So that's kind of how we made our way to where we're at today and trying to find a balance between all of these things. So we're providing for the spiritual needs for those who are healthy enough to be able to come and feel comfortable coming, and yet providing options for those who would have serious, legitimate reasons not to come to Mass, as an example.
Bishop Hagemeier, there has been so much, political division, loss, personal loss, grief. Many pastors have done more funerals this year than they've ever had to tackle before. What do you think the role of faith leaders is, right now going forward, as people still have so many questions and so much unprocessed grief?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a complex question. I describe the ideal of faith leaders is that they provide the leadership to be present in these spaces that you just described and to provide that stability. What that means for me is I talk about safe spaces. You stated it very well. There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of grief. There is something that we would or come to call institutional betrayal. That's not my wording. That comes out of this kind of trauma and grief work that happens where lines were drawn in the sand that go down even families, right, where people stood at a divide and they looked at each other and said, I don't know how we got here, but now we're on opposite ends. And I strongly hold that ground that until we plow through that hard work of coming to terms, as I call it, holy wrestling, right? As we come to terms that we are divided, but because of our faith, we have everything we need to be vulnerable with each other and to lead into the future out of that vulnerability. it won't help us anything to just get back in the pew. Because there's so much that we bring with that we need to have honest, safe spaces to unpack together. And only that will make us stronger and more authentic into living out our faith. And as people of faith, we have God, we have Jesus, we have the Word, we have our liturgies and our case and our faith tradition to help us unpack this. But we need that courage to be vulnerable. And if faith leaders are allowed to be that in their communities, that's where I see the healthiest outcome as we work our way through. Because we will never be, and this is, again, a strong standpoint, but we will never be able to live without COVID. Like, we never live without the flu. But we can learn to live with it. And especially if we're people of faith, and our faith is built on a sure foundation, we can achieve that. And that's what I see our faith leaders, if they're permitted to do that kind of work, that would be the ideal work I can see our faith leaders can lead.
Yeah. Bishop DeGruy, just about 30 seconds or a minute left. What would you add to what Bishop Hagemeyer just said about the role of the church in the days ahead?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly lots of understanding of the tremendous amount of hardship, both on the natural and even supernatural level, not just on COVID, but all the other things that we've experienced in our country and our world right now. So lots of TLC, lots of prayer, lots of encouragement, I think it's going to be very important. So it's attending both to the natural needs of people, so the emotional impact, for example, of COVID, racial tensions, all that kind of stuff, the elections, whatever, helping people process those thoughts, so encouraging people that this is a healthy thing to do, right, to get healthy in mind, body, and spirit, and to be filled with great hope. You know, God is the giver of all good gifts, and so hopefully we all can, as we work on our natural stuff, also look up to the Lord and receive all the good things that he has for us that lies ahead. Those would be my final comments.
Bishop Donald DeGruy, Bishop of Catholic Diocese of Sioux Falls, and Bishop Constanza Hagemeyer with the South Dakota Synod of the ELCA. Constanza, thank you so much. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you too, Lori.
Bishop DeGruy, thank you as well. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. You guys have a great day.